This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Since You Asked is a specialty show that includes articles and columns on advice, commentary, and opinion. This program is funded by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. Views expressed in this program are those of the authors or publications and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or its volunteer readers. My name is Alita, and I am your volunteer reader. Our first article today is Love Letters by Meredith Goldstein from the July 21st, 2026 Boston Globe. I won't have sex before marriage. How do I know if we're compatible? I am a religious person, and in my religion, we believe you do not have intimate relations until marriage. Not everyone gets to experience something before making a big decision. There are probably other signs that two people will get along, right? How do you know if you'll be compatible with simple things, like living together and paying bills? How do you know if you're compatible in other ways, if you're not allowed to engage in anything like that until after marriage? What can you look for in a person that will help you know if you are compatible in other senses, not just humor and physical attraction? Signed, Wondering. From Meredith. I'll start by saying that I haven't known many people who got married before experiencing an intimate and significant courtship. You might want to seek advice from people in your community who can tell you more. But since you came here, 1. Don't discount humor and attraction. They are important, especially the humor part. If you think someone's funny, the relationship is usually much better. Attraction helps a lot. 2. Talk about feelings, even during supervised moments. Explain how this process scares you a bit. Find out if your companion says, "Not me, I'm fine," or if they offer something more revealing, like, "I'm scared too." If there's vulnerability, that's a good sign. 3. Accept chaos. I wish I could tell you there was a way for anyone to predict future compatibility. Even if you've lived with someone, the future is a guessing game. We don't know what will happen and what personal skills we'll need in a relationship. Some of this is about learning along the way. 4. Keep loved ones close, because this I know for sure. It's all easier when you have a strong community. Never stop building it. A love letters recommendation? Listen to A Hollywood Arrangement, our podcast episode about a woman who knows her marriage will be arranged, but also wants the kind of love she's seen in Hollywood rom-coms. The story is revealing and has a happy ending. Signed, Meredith. Readers respond. Agree with Meredith in that getting to know someone involves exploring whether they are honest. Sex may reveal physical compatibility, but it doesn't guarantee emotional compatibility. Can you talk about meaningful things with this person? Can you talk about money? Can you both compromise? How do you resolve small differences? How do you both manage your money? Does he have common sense? Do his parents run his life? So many observable things that will tell you something about what it might be like to live with him. Ask what kind of living and financial arrangements they envision for the future. One guy I dated briefly started telling me how his future wife would only cook the foods allowed on whatever fad diet he was on at the time. I knew right away he was too controlling. I do not follow many religious restrictions, but I never date anyone without a long friendship first. And that friendship is normally based on doing something like volunteer work, which requires us to work together toward a common goal and overcome challenges to do so. It's a great way to learn about other people and myself. I wonder if this approach could be worth trying for you. At worst, you learn how you like to build something long-term and how you prefer to overcome challenges to do so. It has led to some very wholesome romances that ended amicably only due to general life reasons, such as relocation for career goals that neither of us would force the other to give up. I think Meredith has the right idea here. You basically have to talk a lot. It's sometimes hard to know how you will face something, even if you have lived together, especially difficult and rare things like the death of a parent, or infertility. So talk a lot. No subject is too small or big. But also, not to change your mind, but do think about why it's so important to you not to before marriage. I always feel like this thought process tries to create something magical when practical is better. Moving on to the July 16th, 2026 New York Times, Ask the Therapist by Lori Gottlieb. My partner is dying. How do we talk about it? Our Ask the Therapist columnist, Lori Gottlieb, advises a reader who fears discussing end-of-life affairs will make her husband think she wants him gone. My husband has terminal cancer, and I don't know how much time I have left with him. I don't know how to talk to him about end of life. We own a business together, and he is a pivotal part of its ongoing success. I don't know how to do this without him, nor how to ask him without making him think I am looking forward to him dying, which I most certainly am not. I have been in fight or flight mode for 3 years. I am exhausted. From the therapist. I'm so glad you wrote to me because you're describing the experience of watching a spouse die in which most people feel alone. The whiplash of the good news, bad news roller coaster, the stress and fatigue of tending to someone you love, and the confusion about how to broach end-of-life conversations. Carrying so much can be incredibly isolating, which is all the more reason to talk to your husband. But while you still need to discuss business logistics, I want to suggest that you open with a dialogue that centers on grief, his, and also yours. What do I mean? Sometimes people are surprised to learn that when one person in a marriage is seriously ill, grieving doesn't start after the death occurs. Instead, both partners grieve throughout the illness, but often in their own ways. I once treated a woman who was dying of cancer, and although her husband had been loving and attentive throughout their ordeal, he had also been grieving in silence. One night, as he was relaxing in front of the TV, his wife came in to show him another study about a possible experimental cancer treatment that she had found online. He snapped. "Can't we just have one night off from cancer?" he said, uncharacteristically raising his voice, to which she replied, "I don't get a night off from cancer." His reaction didn't make him an uncaring partner. Instead, it brought to the surface something many couples dealing with a terminal illness don't discuss. We experience loss while the person is alive. And because our energy is focused on doctor appointments, tests, and treatments, and because our spouse is still here, we might not be aware that we've already begun grieving. So the grief comes out in other ways, anger or denial, avoidance or distance. How does this relate to you? because not talking about your grief relegates you both to your own silos at the very time you need each other the most. One of your concerns seems to be that talking about your husband's death will make him feel that you're looking forward to his dying. I don't know if you used quotation marks around looking forward because that is what he said, or if it is your own fear. But what if it presents instead an opportunity to talk about what is perhaps his worry over being a burden and yours over how much you'll feel his loss? Another reason spouses might hesitate to talk about their partner's impending death is that they don't want to give the impression that they've lost hope. But there are two kinds of hope. One is hope for more time. The other is hope that whatever time remains can be honest, loving, and less lonely. Silence won't spare either of you. It will only make you face the future separately while you're still together. Talking about his death might be painful, but avoiding it is painful too, both scarier and lonelier. You can ease into the business conversation by starting to talk about your grief, which might go something like this. I love you so much, and I want us to be able to talk to each other about the huge loss we're facing together. I'm already unable to imagine life without you, and I want to know what you're going through too. I don't want either of us to go through this alone. Your husband might not know how to articulate his feelings, but you can ask questions to help guide him. Is there anything you want to say to me now? What are you afraid of? What would comfort you? You can also ask about medical wishes. What kind of care do you want if things change? Who should make decisions? What matters most, being at home instead of hospitalization? You can also gently ask about his wishes around legacy. What do you want me to carry forward? What do you want me to remember most? What would make you feel that your life continues to matter? For example, my dying patient wanted to work on her obituary with me. I'm in no way suggesting that all this happens in one conversation. But by opening the door, you make space for the other important topics, too. Once you start sharing your hopes and fears, your anger and sadness, your love and gratitude, you create a way to communicate about every other difficult thing you've been through with the language of honesty, intimacy, and trust. Then it feels natural when you tell him you're worried you won't know what to do with the business, and that this anxiety is distracting you from what means the most, focusing on being present with him right now. He might even feel relieved that you brought this up because most people who are dying find it comforting to know that their loved ones will be okay. Perhaps the two of you will also consider bringing in a financial professional to help navigate this transition, so you both feel secure that you have the support, should you need it, of another person who has the necessary knowledge to help you run the business smoothly, too. The business conversations matter, and you should make sure to get all the information you need. But don't let them become the substitute for the conversations that might turn out to be among the most loving and meaningful of your marriage. What it's like for him to be dying, and what it's like for you to be losing him, and what you both want to say while you still can. Now, from the July 19th, 2026 Washington Post, Carolyn Hacks, How to Stop In-Laws from Making Everyone Else's Plans Without Asking. Hi, Carolyn. My new in-laws are lovely people, and I enjoy spending time with them. However, they have a tendency to simply tell my spouse and me where and when we're gathering. For example, this is the weekend we're going to celebrate Mom's birthday. without asking if it works for us, even though it requires us to plan and book travel. Last week, they told us where and when they had planned a family trip for next year. We had been on our honeymoon when they made this decision and were not consulted. When we were just dating, I went along with it, though I told my now spouse that I didn't love it. Now that I'm permanently in the picture, I feel strongly that we should have a say in where and how we spend our time and money. My spouse's sibling has small kids and a job that sometimes requires weekend work, so I understand they have less flexibility than we do right now. However, we are still people with responsibilities, commitments, etc. Plus, we want to start our own family and want to set a better precedent before that happens. My spouse supports me in this and has agreed to take the lead in this discussion, but I'd love some advice for how to go about changing the current dynamic. Signed, Newlywed. Newlywed. Oh, I'm sorry we'll miss it. We're not available that weekend. Done. When you can't go, say no. Or when you'd just rather not. This will be harder now than it needed to be. Now it is a change from the go-with-it compliance to which they've become accustomed. Your in-laws' tendency to simply tell my spouse and me where and when we're gathering is presumptuous, yes, and you absolutely deserve control over your own schedule. Because you're adults, no matter your parenthood status. But you made a mistake when you went along with it, even though you disliked it. That gave your in-laws the false impression that you were okay with something when you weren't. Now you need to show them your true face after you've already married their kid. This never goes over as well as letting people know who you are up front, as a policy. First meet, second, 5,000th, same dependability of the face presented. That way you're never staring down a moment of truth like this one. And they aren't either. I realize I'm picking over bygones here, but this is a mistake you don't want to repeat, whether it's with your in-laws or friends or at work, over family weekends or any future kids or assignments. There will be situations where you're not sure yet and will need time to form your position, of course. That's fair. But stick as close to your core principles as you can in the meantime, and you'll minimize the distance people's opinions of you must travel from what they thought they knew to whatever reality turns out to be. Which brings us to your current unwinding of precedent. Since you are adults and adults keep their own calendars, that is the sanest way to change your dynamic. Simply do the thing you always have had the right to do. Yes when you can and want to, no when you can't or don't want to. Because bookings are involved with your in-laws' decrees, do this per your spouse's clear but perfectly loving and kind statement to them. We aren't always available, so please check with us before you commit to dates. Or go big on inclusion. We hate missing things, so please run dates by us first. You fear insulting your in-laws, I presume, or else you would have just said that ages ago. But acting as if no is emotional arson will only make an imagined connection manifest. Living your own life is normal, pardon the screaming, and don't let anyone insist or punish, pout, guilt trip, or whatever worst case you fear otherwise. Also from the Washington Post, this one from the July 16th, 2026 edition, Asking Eric by R. Eric Thomas. Meet and greet with musician led to infatuation. Dear Eric, I'm 70 and very happily married, together 38 years. We both love music, and lately, after seeing a performance, there's a meet and greet with the musicians. A particular musician and I have chatted several times. The last time, I got an autograph and a hug. I am on cloud nine. I love my spouse. I would never cheat. And I have assured my spouse it's like when I was a kid and loved Paul in the Beatles. But now I just can't shake my infatuation and look forward to meeting this musician again. How do I handle my feelings? Signed, Infatuated. Infatuated. Try to right-size your feelings by reminding yourself that what you're responding to is sometimes an intoxicating combination of performance charisma, talent, perhaps celebrity, and music, which we all know carry a lot of emotional weight. In short, you're not really responding to the musician as a person. You're responding to the way the musician's craft and presence make you feel. It doesn't seem like your spouse has any jealousy about it, nor reason to. This is good. The crush does appear to be wholly innocuous. It's common to develop a parasocial relationship with a celebrity, or even a non-celebrity, when we get glimpses into their lives or enjoy their work. Remind yourself that these giddy, infatuated feelings are all part of the act. They're not fake, but they don't have anything to do with your life. Don't dwell on them, though. It can be unhealthy to give into the temptation to fantasize about another meeting or to spend too much time scrolling through the musician's social media account, for example. Instead, redirect it to the music. You're a fan, and that's fine. It's what you want, and that's what the musician wants. Play the tape out. What do you want to happen next? Probably just another chat, right? You don't have intentions of running away together. Remind yourself of that. You might even make your fandom part of your relationship with your spouse by listening to the music together or even making one of the songs your song. Dear Eric, I'm writing from the Delta Sky Club in Atlanta, where I'm honestly stunned by the number of people taking loud business calls on their cell phones. This isn't a case of one person speaking a little too loudly. There are multiple people all around the lounge carrying on full-volume business conversations as if the rest of us are simply part of their office. It makes what should be a quieter, more comfortable travel experience feel like a noisy, open-floor call center. I understand that travel days can be work days, and sometimes people need to take calls. But there seems to be very little awareness that others nearby may be trying to relax, read, eat, or simply enjoy a few minutes of peace before boarding a flight. What is the polite way to handle this? Is it ever appropriate to say something directly to the person? Should I ask lounge staff to intervene? Or is this just the new reality of travel, where everyone is expected to tolerate loud business calls and shared spaces? Signed, Headache in Atlanta. Headache. I placed a call to Delta about this, in an inappropriate place. Unfortunately, I didn't hear back. But whether one is in a lounge or some other public space, it's easy for private conversations to become a public concern, whether it's because of sheer volume or one person's volume. If someone is being particularly loud, you might ask them to keep the volume at a conversational level. Or if the call is on a speaker, you might be better served talking to a staff member and finding out what their policies are. The staff will also be able to direct you to a more peaceful place in the lounge. When all else fails, remind yourself that at least it's quieter in the lounge than it is in the rest of the terminal. Dear Eric, in response to "tired of being kept in the dark," whose parents manage properties that the letter writer will inherit, you could have directed the letter writer to begin teaching him or herself how to manage income property by reading books or attending apartment owners association events near them. Real estate courses at community colleges are also great. I took over my parents' real estate holdings when they were still alive and now manage my own. I learned on the job, asked questions from veterans, and read books. I started 70 years ago, still learning and still going strong. Signed, on the job. Job. I like this. Being proactive about learning the basics may also show the letter writer's parents that the letter writer will be a good steward of the properties that they will one day inherit. And that's it for today. You've been listening to articles and advice columns from our program, Since You Asked. This show is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Alita. I'll be with you again next week. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Zoos can be great places to see birds, and not just in an aviary. Next time you visit, keep an eye out for wild birds that choose to live in this urban green space. One frequent visitor at many zoos is the black-crowned night heron. At the St. Louis Zoo, there's often one hanging around the outdoor penguin exhibit, hoping to steal a stray fish from the penguin's food. Elsewhere, night herons are after more than a quick meal. Since the late 1800s, a large rookery of black-crowned night herons has nested at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo hosts hundreds of night herons. And at the Detroit Zoo, several dozen pairs take up their summer residence in trees near the crocodile exhibit. Night herons love nesting near bodies of water, where they can catch fish, frogs, and other prey. So a zoo that has a pond or two nearby turns out to be a perfect spot for a night heron rookery. Wildlife-friendly landscaping can create opportunities for species that struggle to find habitat elsewhere. For black-crowned night herons, a city zoo can be home sweet home. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
There are more than 1 million English words. Next up, word nerd Steph Donath with some of them worth talking about.
Some words can be traced back to ancient Greek, or Latin, or the Middle English of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, or Shakespeare's plays. Then there's codswallop. Yes, I said codswallop. If you think it has something to do with being slapped in your face by a fish, you just might be right. You see, no one really knows where it comes from. Many dictionaries do not even guess at its origin. My favorite guess goes back to England in the late 1800s when beer was often called wallop. The stronger the beer, the stronger the wallop. The story goes that a man named Cod invented a non-alcoholic beer, and it was soon called Cod's Wallop. And it meant then just what it means now. It means nonsense, absurd, or just plain ridiculous. Non-alcoholic beer, Cod's Wallop.
That's enough talk about words. Let's go back to listening to them.